This is George Hemmen, recorded by Chris Eldon Lee on the 8th of November, 2010. George Hemmen, Part 2. When you left Deception at the end of that 54 season, were you expecting to return to the Antarctic again?
I had no idea. I mean, we left at the end of the 54 summer, which must have been about April time. Which I can't remember the dates, but it would have put us back into this country around about June time, I guess. And then I had 3 months paid leave. That was the end of contract. I wanted to... Two things I wanted to do. One, I wanted to go back south.
Why?
Because I loved it. But I also wanted to go back as a surveyor, which was the trade I'd learned in the army. But, of course, I hadn't followed this for many years, and I talked to Secretary Fidds in London, and Fidds agreed to... that I could go back and do another winter or two winters or whatever I wanted, and that they would send me on a one-to-one brush-up survey course with the Professor of Geography at Imperial College, which was Alfred Stevenson at that time, who'd been on the British Greyhound expedition. Anyway,
How did you get on with him?
Fine. Oh, yeah, absolutely fine. So that was the plan. And so I happily went off back home and, you know, sort of waiting for a date to go to Imperial College. When in August of 1955, a telegraph boy came up the drive one morning and delivered a telegram. And it was a lovely telegram. You must have heard the story. Oh, did you not see the transcript of the Halley 50?
Tell me the story, please, George.
Okay.
Well, even though I'm shaking my head.
The telegram said, next time you are in London, will you please call in the office because I have something important I wish to discuss? I thought, oh, God, what's this?
Was that from Fuchs?
No, this was from Frank Elliott, who was the Secretary of Fidds at the time. And I thought, oh, God, is this anything to do with my survey course or what? What is it all about? Anyway, you get a telegram like that, what do? You pack a bag and get on the next train to find out what the hell it's all about. And this was August 1955, and he told me then that about the International Geophysical Year, and that Fidds had undertaken to look after the coordination of all the logistics, you know, for a Halley Bay operation, using their knowledge and experience and the Crown Agent's facilities and knowledge. But they hadn't got anybody to do it because their London staff consisted of one secretary only.
When they say to do it, what do you mean?
To organise the coordination of all the logistics, stores, supplies, ship charter, everything, which was the Crown Agents actually were the experts in doing, but we had to tell, somebody had to tell them what was needed. And but Fidds had undertaken to do this on behalf of the Royal Society, so would I do it?
How long did you take to think about the answer?
5 minutes. But that put in, you know, it was only a year. It was only going to put off my return to the Antarctic for a year. So, you know, it was just a sort of... and this was mid-August, and the ship had to sail in mid-November. It's just 3 months.
So this is the desk job they were offering you, really?
Yeah, yeah. So there was a... you know, you just had to... You didn't really have much time to think about it. You only got 3 months, let's get started as soon as possible.
Well, I suppose you didn't have much choice either, because if your ambition was to go south, saying no at this point presumably would have been bad for your ambition.
Yeah, that didn't occur to me. All it was that this is something that needs to be done. Yeah. Obviously, it's important, and it's only going to put off my return by a year, so that's neither here nor there. And in fact, it never happened.
It never happened?
I happened, but I never got to go back as a surveyor.
So what did you do? You spent those 3 or 4 months putting together the logic.
Yeah, and then I went down with the... I took the ship down as charterer's representative and all that, and there was quite a lot to do on the way down on the store side of things because, you know, you get these packing lists and you have to know what's in which box and, you know, anyway, that... there was quite a lot to be done. When we would actually got down as far as... we were heading for 78 South, which was the Vassal Bay area. But we got well and truly stopped at about 76 and a half and came back north a bit and tried a couple of landing places. There were only 3 of us on that ship that had been in the Antarctic before, and so we formed the reconnaissance party that when we saw somewhere you could get ashore and get up a slope, because the whole of that area is bounded by the ice front, which is, what, 90 to 100 feet high, with very, very few breaks in it. And first couple of landings were hopeless, and then the third one, there was a nice little bay with some good-looking sea ice and nice slope at the back of it up to the top. So we went up there and got to the top, and it was just unbelievable. It was as flat as a billiard table as far as you could see. So we went in about mile and a half, something like that. Still looked pretty good. So that was where we said, okay, this is the spot.
The spot for what?
For building the Royal Society Station. It was within the latitude that had been specified. It was south of 75 degrees south. And as it happened, it turned out to be a pretty good location because I think it's only 1 year since then that ships have not been able to get in. And it turned out to be right in under the auroral belt, which was excellent from the geophysical observation point of view.
It was also, of course, on the ice shelf. It wasn't actually on the continent.
No, as I was saying, I mean, this shelf, the front of the shelf is 90 to 100 feet high. Aren't many places you can get up onto that. And this was one of them.
Was that expected? Were you expected to be creating a space on floating ice?
Yes. Oh, yes. I mean, the hut was designed for that very purpose.
How was it designed then? Because... rumour has it wasn't a terribly successful design.
It was a very successful design. Now, let's think, what are you thinking of? I've seen this comment before. I've heard this comment.
Well, it didn't last long on the surface, did it? It sank.
It didn't need to last long on the surface. It just needed to last. And it was designed for the IGY, which was 2-year operation, 3 years. What happens if you start, you put a mat down of expanded metal, then on top of that some huge levelling timbers, about sort of 6x8, and then your foundation, the grillage for your floor, and anyway, it's all the timber building. I'll tell you a bit more about the routine of that, but the building itself was 128 feet long, and... by the following summer, it was pretty well covered. But by the end of the IGY, it was virtually completely covered, and the only way in and out was through the roof, hatch in the roof. But it had done its job by then. That was what was required of it. And at the end of the IGY, the station was taken over by FIDS. Mm. And so the hut did last a few more years. And then they had to build another one. And in fact, they are now building the 6th station on that location, because the first one went out to sea years ago. Somebody once told me, I forget who it was now, which is a shame, but they had a picture of it sticking out of an iceberg.
I've heard about this. Yeah. People seeing it.
You've seen it?
No, I haven't seen the photograph. No, I've heard people telling about seeing appearing through the ice.
Yeah, I'd love to see that picture, but I forget who told me about it. But I was promised a copy of it. It never came.
So at this point, I think you were called the Totten III, is that correct, on this ship? The advanced search party looking for...
The advanced party, there were 10 men in the advanced party. David Dalglish was the leader of the advanced party. He'd been down in Pidge earlier. Ken Powell, who was the diesel mech, he'd been Hope Bay, and myself. These were the three that...
FIDs. Pre-FIDs, earlier
FIDs. Three ex-FIDs, yeah. Yeah. And the rest of them, the other seven, the other eight, had not been in the Antarctic before. So, but anyway, to go back to the beginning, yes, we, so far as I was concerned, it was 1 year operation. But when I got back, I was asked if I'd do the same for the main party. And then I was asked if I'd stay on and bring them all back at the end of the IGY and see to the handover to FIDS. So now this was 3 years on, and then, well, we'll come on to the other bit later on, what happened after that. But Totten sailed from Southampton on the 22nd of November 1955, something like that. But that was a bit hairy because, I don't know if you've seen the pictures of it. Well, the ship was loaded, and then there was planking and gas cylinders and God knows what being piled on the deck. And the Board of Trade man came along and said, stop. I don't think that ship is going to be very safe if you put much more on it. So they had to conduct some stability tests, and they said, okay, you can take another X tons aboard. But by this time, it was quite interesting. George Ush, whom you mentioned, Ken Powell, and Robin Dalglish, who are the three tractor people, there was still a tractor sitting on the quayside, which looked as though we weren't going to be able to take. We got two aboard, but not the third one. So they nipped off the ship, broke the case open, and took all the bits that valuable, most useful bits, off it as spares, and shoved all these under their bunk in the accommodation. So anyway, eventually the Board of Trade man said, okay, you can take so much more. And that tractor was one thing that went back on board. And that's what you see in that picture of them sort of putting it back together on the ship in the tropics. But we had to leave the second floor of the hut behind. Just couldn't take it.
Was that bad planning from somebody then? Was it?
Not really. I mean, it was pretty much... It was just busting at the seams. It might have been... Not really, because, you know the capacity. You know how much you've got in cubic footage of cargo. You know the cubic capacity of your ship's holds. And it's not always exactly the same thing that you can put a pint into a pint pot if it's all boxes and...
How much damage did that do to your plans when you got south, having to leave some of it behind?
Nothing, not at all. No. Not at all. No. No. I mean, what happened then? Okay, the ship sailed. We had to call in at... Las Palmas in the Canaries, which was not planned because Johnny Raymond had bust his arm some cargo broke loose in a storm, and he hurt his arm. Now, you can't have a chippy with a broken arm. It's not a lot of good, is it?
That was Johnny Raymond, not George Lush.
No, Johnny Raymond. No, George Lush bust his arm later. then we called in at Rio. Now, this is a nice little story, too. we nearly ran into serious trouble in Rio.
Go on.
Because our captain, Leif Jakobsen, goes along to the ship's chancellor and said he wants a load of dynamite. Well, you know, Norwegian sailing ship captain, just go and buy dynamite if you're going into the ice. But, of course, what he didn't realise was that there was a revolution going on at the time. So the police were somewhat interested in this guy that was trying to buy dynamite. Anyway, it all blew over. And then we got to South Georgia on Christmas Day, sailed on Boxing Day, hit some ice about 3 days later, got through that, and then you get into this wonderful shore lead, about 600-800 miles. You've got this ice front, the front of the ice shelf, which I say is 1,900 feet high. Then you've got the beautiful open water, blue skies. Life is idyllic. And then, of course, you've got the ice, but that's not holding you back until we hit it at 76.5.
Which is the Weddell Pack you met?
Yeah. That's 76.5. It's about 4 miles from where Shackleton Endurance got stuck.
Was that an ominous thought in your head at that time?
No, I don't think we realised it at that time. It was afterwards when you sort of look at the latitude and longitude. Oh, my God.
And looking for so just to recap again and perhaps put a bit more detail into this, looking for the site for the IGY hut, which then became Halley Bay, just remind me of the criteria that were most important to you for finding the right place.
Well, the first of all, you've got to find a break in the front of the ice shelf, and that usually means somewhere where there's some under ice or undersea feature which is causing the flowing ice to break up a bit, and then you'll have a gap in the ice front and maybe a slope behind it which is filled up with snow, which gives you access to the top. Not very many places in that same. But the criterion, essential one, was it had to be south of 75 south.
Because?
That was the instruction, that was what the... If it wasn't south of 75 degrees south, it was going to be of less value to the IGY.
So geophysically, it had to be that far south?
That was the requirement, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Vassal Bay, which was our target place, was 78-ish. But we were just, I mean, after 8,000 miles, to be held up just 90 miles short of your target's a bit bit hard, but nothing you can do about it.
So did you personally oversee the construction of the IGY base?
No. As I recall, we got there January the 6th, 1955, and everything was busy unloading. Okay, there's all sorts of tales about the unloading.
Such as? Give me a little example.
Well, one classic example, when there must have been some breakup or some tipping over of an iceberg, but there was a sort of a tidal wave ran through the sea ice in Halley Bay and just sort of broke it up. And they could see this from the ship, which sort of pushed off, had to get out of the way. But at that moment, one of the tractors was coming back down the slope. And, of course, he couldn't see this, which was a bit hairy at that moment. Anyway, that worked. But, I mean, that's the sort of thing that, you know, you can't predict. It just the ice just broke up. No, that was till about the... I suppose we were all busy unloading. You couldn't leave anything on the ice unless there was a sledge and a tractor there to take it away for this sort of reason. And the other thing was that the temperatures were sort of round about zero.
Fahrenheit or centigrade?
Centigrade. Which meant the surfaces were a bit sticky, which was not good. So we had to give up working during the day and work during the night. The sun was a bit lower, but it was still up 24 hours a day. So we worked at night. And that was till about the 15th. And then started laying the foundations for the hut. So that was the everything, all the timber was up there by this time, all the materials, and there was Johnny Raymond and Doug Pryor, the two carpenters, and myself, because I was up there keeping overseeing what was going on up there, and I got the odd light out because we had been told by the designers how critical it was to get these levelling timbers absolutely level.
Right.
So Johnny had the sort of levelling pole and I had the theod light and we got this first one perfect. And we put the second one in, that was okay. And then we started to lay the third one down, by which time the first one had gone out of level. So all this perfect levelling...
The ice was flexing that much, was it?
Well, no. Of course, as soon as you put something on the ice...
It melts.
Radiation, warmth, melts, tips. Anyway, Johnny said, oh, to hell with it, you know, we'll just sort of do the best we can. And this critical levelling wasn't that critical after all.
That's a slightly surprising... I mean, I know Fidge was fairly Fred Karno in those days, but that's a slightly surprising oversight, isn't it?
I don't think so, because one would have thought that the mat, the mat underneath would have... I don't know, you don't know what radiation does. Anyway, they got the foundation. I've got a nice picture of the foundation.
So in the end it was all done by rule of thumb and...
Yeah. Lick your finger and... or as Johnny's favourite phrase was, fix it quick before the governor comes. the foundations were all nicely down. The tents were up for the boys to live in. And then, of course, Totten, I came back with Totten. We left there on the 22nd of January, something like that.
So you were there just for a few weeks, literally?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but you made two more return visits, I believe.
That's right, because I was coordinating the logistics for the main party, and took them down on Magadan, and we shared Magadan with the Transantarctic expedition that year, and we only had half the cargo space. By the time everything was being ordered, new huts, more huts, non-magnetic huts, generator sheds, balloon huts, all this sort of thing, and more aerials, it was obvious that we weren't going to get it all into Magadan, half of Magadan, so we had to charter Totten again, which was fine. And she got down there first, much to everybody's delight. You know, the one's the fancy ship, the other's the little struggling one, because and then in the final year there was the handover to Fids and the bringing them all back. So
well first of all, one is getting the impression that money was no object. Is that the case, or was that...
No, there was a limit to it, of course, but I didn't really have, personally, I was being, you know, you had to be economic, but you had to be sensible. You couldn't take shortcuts. And I wasn't really aware that there was a restriction on what needed to be done financially. There must have been, but I don't really recall it.
What sights came to your eyes when you went down the second summer?
Well, the first thing, of course, was that it was that wonderful picture of the... Have you seen it?
Go on.
Of the hut 12 months on. Have you got that?
I'll look at it later, George. Yeah. Just describe what you saw. This is radio, so describe what you saw.
There was this hut virtually up to the eaves, buried. And access was, but it had been completed. It was very, very comfortable inside. It was huge, and the boys from the main party who were going into it all seemed quite happy with what they were going to be living in for the next year. I know, it was fine.
So the hut had sunk into the ice evenly, on an even
well,
keel.
Oh, yes. Well, don't forget, as soon as you put something on down on the ice and you get a bit of a blow, then your drift is going to start building up. So it was a combination of drifting snow and precipitation, rather than the hut actually sinking.
Hmm. So when you saw that hut up to its eaves in snow, that was what you were expecting to see, or did it come as a slight surprise?
It came as a little bit of a surprise to see it that far down, I must say. But there we are.
And was it pretty much complete?
Oh, yes, the hut was complete by that time. That the main hut was. That was the whole object. I mean, the advance party's task was to find a site and to build the main accommodation hut, which, as I say, was 128 feet by about 27, a big building for that part of the world.
And the second summer's duties were what were you hoping to achieve in your second rather brief visit?
Well, just much the same. I had to take them down and, any problems with the ships, and I was there and put them in and brought the advance party back home.
So again, you were acting as the hirer's representative, so
yeah,
to speak.
Yeah.
Were there any problems that second summer, things that had to be dealt with that you weren't expecting?
No, I don't think so. the ship got stuck in ice a few times, but then they always do, and you dig it out. And I really don't know what happens in this day and age, because I'm quite sure health and safety wouldn't look kindly on people leaping over the side of a ship to dig it out with poles and... I don't know, maybe they do it that way, I don't know. I did ask one of the captains once, but never got an answer.
Were you there to see Fuchs depart on his transantarctic expedition?
No, because they... Okay, in 1955, end of 1955, the plan was that Bunny's ship, Theron, which is a Canadian sealer, would sail a week before us, and we would follow them down. And the target for both expeditions was Fossil Bay. The plan was to build two stations adjacent to each other. They got badly stuck in the northern part of the Weddell Sea, and we kept going east and further east and got round that. But we couldn't get further, let's say, than 76 and a half. We tried twice, but it was just impossible. But the requirement for us was not that critical. 75 south was our...
Mm.
Anyway, between 75 and 78, 75 and a half, 75 and 78. And when I'd left by the time Theron came through, and Bunny had an aeroplane, and they took off, and they could see from the air that that site at Halley Bay wouldn't have been any good for them at all, because further in there were far too many crevasses. So they then pressed on, and they in fact got through to Vassal Bay. But their story, I'm sure you've got from other people.
Right.
And what that awful... how they survived that first winter takes some believing.
How do you mean? What's your admiration?
Well, the Theron got down to Shackleton, okay. Got down to the base, which was called to Vassal Bay, and the name of that station became Shackleton. But, of course, it was getting a bit late in the season, and they couldn't hang around too long, otherwise they'd be completely stuck. So they unloaded all their gear, and they were taking stuff up to the site as and when they could, and... then it'll be in the record that after the ship had left, there was this storm and the ice went out and took oh, I don't know, half their coal, half their anthracite and a load of their timber and goodness knows what else out with them. So they were in a bit of a dire straits at that time. But that's all in the TAE record.
But you were aware of that at the time, were you?
No, I wasn't. No. It's just something I became aware of afterwards. I mean, I was on the way home by then.
And the third summer? Well, why did you go a third time?
The third time? Mm. Well, as I say, that was to two reasons. One, to hand the station over to FIDS, and also to bring our main party back home.
Mm. On balance, do you think the IGY was a scientific success? Were people delighted with the results?
It was a magnificent success. It was a magnificent success in many, many ways. It saw the spawning of the whole concept of world data center systems. It was the first of what were to become a long series of international, multinational, collaborative studies of major problems of the world. There was an international geological correlation program. There was another study a few years after the IGY, which was designed, as I said, at a time of maximum solar activity. A few years later, period of minimum solar activity, there was another international, multinational program. There was another scientific committee of ICSU set up to look at problems in the environment. But then there were organisations that sprung from all this, like SCORE and SCAR, which have just gone from strength to strength ever since. And they're still vitally important today.
So how different would the story of the Antarctic in modern times be if IGY had A, not happened, or B, been a bit of a flop?
That's a good question. Very good question. I don't know. I suppose if it had not been a success, a lot of nations would have not continued. Difficult to tell.
To what do you attribute the success? You've described what was successful, but underneath all that, what was it that enabled it to be a success?
I think that what enabled it to be a success was something that Georges Laclavaire said at the very first meeting of the International Planning Committee, that we are here to plan, to talk about the scientific and technical aspects of this program, politics and all that sort of thing is nothing to do with us. Mm. And that was the sort of theme that's been continued ever since. The scientific groups talk about the science. And that's it.
Leave your guns at the door.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The old cowboy style.
And that, to my mind, is one of the great, if you like, achievements of these international programmes. But especially, as I say, it's going on today. The world ocean covers 7/10 of the world. The Antarctic continent covers a pretty hefty chunk. International collaboration in both these areas is still going on. Wonderful.
You when you came away from Halley from that third trip away, did you still hanker to go back? Or had you sated your appetite?
I think by that time I was now, what, 30? Yes, no, one, yes, 30 odd. I realised that, listen, laddie, you've got to get yourself a job. And this was what we're talking about, 1959. Yes, I was into my 30s, 33. I really had to think seriously about getting a job. And that really was... going back again would not have been a sensible move. But I never had to bother.
What do you mean?
Well, I never needed to look for a job. I was conscious that I had to find one. But then I was asked by the Royal Society What had happened was towards the latter part of 1958, at the time of the celebration of the centenary of the publication of Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species, the Royal Society decided that they wouldn't just celebrate this with the usual round of receptions and such like, but they would also send a scientific expedition back out to that part of the world where Darwin did a lot of his work with a specific scientific objective in mind. And that was, it was realised that there were similarities between the fauna and flora of southern South America and South Island of New Zealand. Mm. So let's send an expedition out there, small one, 5 months, to look at these issues. And again, I was sitting with my office over at Crown Agents this time, and again, with the backing of Crown Agents, the Royal Society said, well, look, you know, would you look after the stores and side of this, which we did. And because of the success of the IGY operation, this big thing, and the success of this small mobile party, the Royal Society felt that there was a lot of knowledge and experience. Martin Holgate, for instance, who led the Chilean expedition, and the people who had planned it all on the scientific side, and me on the logistics side. They didn't want to lose that, and so they thought, well, what we can do is set up a scientific advisory, a scientific expeditions advisory service, and an expeditions department, and they asked me if I'd join the staff and head that up, which I did. I mean, I didn't take 5 minutes to say yes or no. I mean, it was a dream come true.
So Mr. Darwin, or Mrs. Darwin's timing was very good, wasn't it?
Absolutely. No, and so of course, that was mid-end 1959. But then 1960 was the tercentenary year of the Royal Society, and everything was all focused on that at that time. And it came into about 1960 before the expeditionary side of things started to pick up.
Was there a lot of fuss made about Darwin's centenary, the publication centenary? We just last year celebrated, I'm from Shrewsbury so I know, the bicentenary of his birth and the 150 years
yes.
anniversary of the book, and he was everywhere.
Oh yes, yes.
Including the back of the 10 bob note.
Yes, but, indeed he was.
What about 50 years previously? Was Darwin's anniversary a big one?
Oh, it was a very big one. They made a film about it. I can't remember the name of the film, but it was probably Darwin and the Beagle, I suspect. But, you know, it was a major film production. Alan Moorhead wrote a book, a new book. They made quite a
So the projects you were helping to plan were high-profile projects?
I'm not so sure that the project, the expedition, was particularly high-profile. The centenary of the publication was, but the expedition, I don't think that was. Tell you a lovely little story, if you want asides. Martin brought back one of the... Chilean. Do you remember Picture Post and those sorts of glossy weeklies?
This is Martin Holgate.
Yeah, yeah. Some of these glossy weeklies. Of course, Chileans had a similar sort of thing. And he brought back one of these. And there was a lovely description of the planning of this expedition by the Royal Society, of these long, grey-beard gentlemen in sitting in Burlington House in the committee rooms there in London, smoking their big fat cigars and drinking their glasses of whiskey, planning this expedition. A bit far from the truth, but sounded good. Right.
There's a gap in my notes now of a couple of decades, in fact. So were you working for that organisation for several years?
For the Royal?
Mm.
Yes. You were. I joined the staff in 1959 and I retired from them in 1985.
And this is the Royal Geographical...
No, it's
the Royal Society.
The Royal Society.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And that was what that talk was that I gave. Just.
And then all that time you had no plans to go back to the Antarctic?
No.
But you couldn't. You didn't leave it behind, did you? Because
not entirely, no. Because from the IGY, the first thing that, if you like, came out of that was the formation of BIOCSU, of its Scientific Committee on Oceanic Research. And the second thing, a year later, or the following year, was the formation of Scientific Committee on Antarctic Research. And, of course, the third one was the Scientific Committee on Space Research. But the Royal Society, being the UK adhering body to ICSU, International Council of Scientific Unions, had formed national committees for all these organisations. And I was responsible for running the national committee, British national committees for oceanic research and Antarctic research. Now, the SCAR, Scientific Committee on Antarctic Research, elected Gordon Robin, who was director of Scott Polar, as its secretary, and I think it was about 1960. But Gordon said that he wouldn't be able to manage to do to this administrative work without some support. And so David Martin, who was the secretary of the Royal Society at the time, was happy for me to provide that support.
So when did you start at SCAR?
I would guess it was around about 1961, somewhere about there.
Till
Peter will tell you that, it's in his record.
Till
1990?
And SCOR, same time?
SCOR, again, now don't forget, ocean science in those days was really growing. And we were running the British National Committee, and George Deacon was our chairman. He was the director of the National Institute of Oceanography in Wormley in Surrey, which is now, we won't go into what it all now is. It's down in Southampton. It's grown and grown. But SCOR was growing as well, and the first major thing that they undertook was an international study of in the Indian Ocean.
Mm.
A lot of things resulted from that, and as British National Committee, we were much involved in all this, and it all started off with Roger Revell was the president, and then he had to leave. His term was expired, and Luis Capuro, the Argentine ex-hydrographer, he became president of SCOR, and he was supported as secretary by Warren Worcester, who had come from UNESCO's Office of Oceanography. That's all another story. Now, Warren then became president of SCOR. And in those early days, he was able to devote a lot of time to it. He had a professorship in Miami, so he really virtually ran the secretariat as well as being president. But when his term came to an end, there was a problem, because by this time it was taking so much time. And this, I can give you a date, but not off the top of my head. It was sort of well in, it must have been 1972, around about then. And the agreement was that Ron Curry, who was by that time, he'd been at National Institute of Oceanography, he's now director of the Scottish Marine Biological Association Laboratory in Oban, that he would take on a secretary if he could have some support. So again, David Martin, who saw the Royal Society, role as being reflected in all this sort of thing, said, OK, you can do that as well.
So you ran the two posts side by side?
For a while, yes.
For a while,
three, and the expeditions. Yeah, for 8 years I ran. I was the SCORE executive secretary. And SCORE all those years. But we're sticking with it. We're supposed to be talking about the Antarctic, you know.
Let's just talk. But it's good to get the context. But let's just talk for a few minutes now about what you were able to achieve with SCAR during your time there, because it's nearly 30 years, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you took it from something fairly embryonic.
Oh yes, yes, yes. Oh yes, it grew and grew.
What do you regard to be your major breakthroughs, your major achievements, on the back of a postage stamp, George?
Well, it's difficult to say, isn't it? You can't put your finger on. I mean, it's the achievements of SCAR, not the achievements of George Heaven, because he didn't achieve anything. some of the notable things, I suppose. There was a big study into the mineral resources, the effects on the environment and all that sort of thing. A big effort went into things like Global Atmospheric Research Program and then the World Climate Research Program. Then there was the very, very big biomass experiment, which was, again, a multinational, multi-ship, multi-year operation to study the whole marine ecosystem of the Southern Oceans. Because, of course, the focus of that was the krill. Mm. Now, the krill had been the foodstuffs of the big whales.
Mm.
And the big whales had all been killed off, so there was a surplus of, apparently, thought to be a surplus of krill. Some estimates said there was a sustainable cat take of protein from that, equivalent to total world fishery landings, which would have been a bonus for them. But was that true? Or were other things now moving in, like seals? Were they maturing younger? Anyway, this big international program was set up to look into that. And the convener of that was Syed El Syed from Texas. The data center, a biological data center, was established in the British Antarctic Survey. That was a big achievement.
Was it all sweetness and light all the time, or did you have a few sticky moments?
Oh, you're always going to have sticky moments. But one of the, in the early days, particularly in SCAR, it was really quite good, because if you were in a meeting and you came to a sticky moment, something really, you know, really sticking in the discussion between a few nations, the president would say, well, OK, look, let's leave on that and come back to it tomorrow. A bottle of whiskey in a hotel room can sort out so many problems.
So did the scientists always leave their guns at the door? Pretty much. In those 30 years, did politics ever
all right
get in the way?
I'll tell you this story. It's a classic of its kind. It sort of illustrates intergovernmental meeting on the Southern Ocean, by which time UNESCO had, or the United Nations, had banned all communication with South Africa. Do you remember those years?
Mm. But then it Basil D'Oliveira.
But South Africa was a member of the International Coordination Group for the Southern Ocean. But they weren't allowed to be communicated with, so they were never told when there was to be a meeting.
Yes.
They hadn't actually been thrown out.
They just weren't invited.
They just were never told that there was to be a meeting. Well, of course, you know, friends are friends, and they, shall we say, learned when there was going to be a meeting.
You mean they mysteriously turned up?
They mysteriously turned up. But of course, the one of the delegations, I won't tell you which one because that could be a bit tricky, had a brief from their government to object to this. And go into all the ins and outs of United Nations resolutions, banning communication with South Africa, blah, 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 blah. And he went all through this in his own language. And when he'd finished his spiel, he plonked his papers on the table and said, in English, right, now let's get on with the business.
So the protest note diplomacy was still very much in evidence.
That's right.
Even then.
And this was at an intergovernmental meeting.
And that was in the, what year did you say it was, roughly? Sometime in the 60s?
No. It'd be after that. Probably in the late 70s, early 80s.
What kind of kerfuffle was there in the world of SCAR in April 82, when April 1982, when the Argentinians set sail?
Didn't make any difference to us. We still communicated with them. They communicated with us. And so I told you the story when I met them in the hotel.
And how about 3 years later when news began to filter out about the discovery of the holes in the ozone layer? Was that did that have a significant impact on SCAR?
That was after I had... That was in the 1990s, wasn't it?
25 years ago.
25, yeah. It was about the time I was retiring. No, this was Joe Farman discovering this. Whole, no, I mean, it was a very real thing. And again, you see, this is where the international side comes in. The Americans picked this up. And they had all these satellites whizzing around. They were able to look at it in much more depth and confirmed it all.
So you'd left by that point, had you?
Yeah.
In 85. Yeah. So you were there for about 25 years, not 30 years, as I
was saying. Yeah, probably
something like that. Yeah. So you left SCAR in around about 1985. And was that the end of your relationship with the Antarctic, or did you still...
No. Yes, it was. Oh, yes, yes. When I left SCAR, my last SCAR meeting was 1990, wasn't it? And that was it.
You left in 1990?
Yes.
So it was 30 years?
Yes, I handed over to... I had retired from the Royal Society in 1985.
Right.
But I kept SCAR on, and I was still involved in another programme on a part-time basis.
So just to get my facts right, you were at SCAR when the ozone hole was discovered in 85.
Was it 85, as early as that?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
I hope I'm right.
Yeah.
We've just had the 25th anniversary.
Yeah, okay, fine. Mm. Yeah. No, I mean, it was just another of these things,
Right, it doesn't matter. Okay.
It was notable, of course.
So I was asking you to explain whether you still had contact with the Antarctic after you'd left SCAR, when you stopped dealing with it.
Yeah, professionally I stopped.
But as a retired gentleman?
Yeah, but when the 50th anniversary of the establishment was 1996.
The establishment of Halley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's 2006, what am I talking about?
Yeah.
2006, there was this reunion organised in Northampton for anybody who had ever been to Halley Bay. And I was asked if I'd do a little presentation on the very beginning.
Was the event? I didn't get to that one. It's just before I became more deeply involved. Tell me what it was like, that
Oh, it was absolutely superb. There were something like 250 people who had been there, and there were about 150 wives and girlfriends, and there were about 400 there altogether, weren't there? And they had a video link to Halley Bay. Video links, I ask you. They had a video link to Halley Bay, which was great. Oh, it was a fantastic couple of days.
When a base has been going that long, and with so many people involved, do you get a sense of base community over all those decades?
I think you do. I mean, Andy Smith is the focus of, if you like, the camaraderie, but he produces this Base Z newsletter, and there's always little snippets of what's going on there. And I think there is a sort of a kind of... There isn't. They don't have reunions every 5 minutes like some of the bases do, and probably every 25 years. But no, I mean it was a very nice atmosphere, I must say, and there is that sort of camaraderie about.
Andy Smith may well be transcribing this interview for us. He does that.
Does he? Yeah. Oh, well. Okay.
Particularly with ex-Halleyites.
Yes, he's an ex-Halleyite.
My final question, unless there's something else you wanted to say, concerns the Hemmen Ice Rise.
Right.
Now, you're the first Fid I've ever come across to have an ice rise named after them. So tell me about it. First of all, how did you find out?
How did I find out? I was informed by Charles Swinnerbank.
Have you been to see your ice rise at any point?
No. No, that's way down on the Filter Ice Shelf. No, I've never seen it. I'd love to. But no, it was just, a feature. I think Charles was behind it, and the Antarctic Place Names Committee, which is a Foreign Office thing, had obviously approved the naming of this ice rise, and there it is. It's on the map.
How long ago was it named? Which decade?
I would think it was probably in the 1990s. I could tell you.
Hmm.
I could certainly look it up.
So it was many, many years later.
Oh, yeah. I could certainly tell you. But I have a lake named after me as well.
Do you?
Yeah.
Where's that?
It's not in the Antarctic. in central Brazil.
Well, you're the first Fid I've ever met to have two topographical features named after them.
And I'm sure Gordon's got some things named after him. Gordon Robin.
Hmm.
But,
have you?
What else? Yes, there must be others. There must be many others.
I haven't met them, though.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
So, summing up, then, how do you regard the Antarctic in your life?
I would say it's dominantly important, or has been, and it has the most wonderful experience, and it's an experience that you don't forget, and it's something I'm so delighted that I did, and quite honestly, it is really what. The basis of what I've done in the rest of my life. It was the gateway, the doorway that was opened for me to do what I did with the Royal. You know, one thing leads to another.
So
yeah.
Responding to that advert in the Daily Telegraph was a good thing.
Oh, it certainly was a good thing.
It's been great, George. Thank you very much.